On this episode of the D&D Podcast, we talk about the Monster Manual 3 with Mike and Jeremy, and an interview with Robert Schwalb.
Welcome once again to the D&D Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me as usual is my sidekick, Jeremy Crawford.
This again.
Yes, this again.
That would be your co-host,
Jeremy. We didn't catch this because we had to edit it out, but I had a brilliant opening ruined by someone deciding to clear their throat like halfway through my great intro. And also and guest starring once again is Shelley Mazenoble.
Hello.
So we're here to talk Monster Manual 3. So Shelley, from what I've been told, you have some questions for us.
I do, yes. As you know, as player in chief, I strongly object to the design of monsters.
Really?
All monsters must be stopped as a player.
So you object to their very existence.
To their very existence.
That's not very tolerant.
No. I mean, unless they have, you know, they could be trained and kept as pets.
That's awful.
But I have spent a lot of quality time with Monster Manual 3 lately, flipping through the pages, and it got me thinking a little bit about the design of monsters, and I'm sure that there's more to it than just a doodle on a notebook, and like, but maybe not. Yeah. I really don't know, and in a way, I picture like all these monsters lining up to audition, kind of like American Idol style, and wearing a number around their chest, and they're like, hello, tell us a little bit about yourself, I'm like, hello, my name is Orcus, and I'm from wherever, and these are some of the things I can do. Is it anything like that?
It is actually, it's actually very much like that.
Where am I on audition day?
No, and it's based, so I was lead designer on MM3, and this was my first chance to sort of make a monster manual the way I wanted to make one.
Ooh.
And it definitely had this element of, you know, if you want to be in this book, you have to impress me. Now, and it's also like any sort of judging process, it was thoroughly corrupt. So, for example, the cave fisher is one of my favorite monsters. It was an MM2 for first edition.
Actually, that one reminds me of my cat.
Really?
Yes.
And that always grabbing stuff.
Yes,
holding stuff.
Me.
There you go. Well,
it's interesting, the pet associations, because Mike, isn't the Maw Demon based on your dog, Bailey?
The Maw Demon is based on my dog, Bailey.
You okay? I was going to ask about inspiration. But
Bailey is basically a wandering digestive tract.
So this is the one that eats your sandwiches.
No, that's the cat.
Oh, okay.
This is one of the cats. But Bailey is a small chihuahua mutt we got from the shelter a couple years ago now. And Bailey loves to eat. He's very food-centered. Our other dog, Lulu, who grew up in a sort of more loving environment, because Bailey they found like wandering in a field when he was like, you know, two or something like that. Bailey is always convinced that his next meal will be his last, so he's always trying to eat as much as he can.
I can relate to Bailey.
Yeah, and
I
so
eat like that too.
So if you so if you look at the Maw Demon, when I wrote up the Maw Demon, I decided to throw a little tribute to my crazy dog. My spastic little dog. He runs laps around the house. That's how when he gets excited, he runs around in circles around the entire house. The first sentence, some demons are cunning, others are strong. A Maw Demon is neither. Its simple brain understands two concepts, hunger and food. Its body consists of little more than a bulbous belly, a massive mouth, and stumpy legs that carry it from meal to meal.
Which does describe Bailey.
That is my dog.
But this is the picture here.
Right, and that's
which this looks nothing like a chihuahua mutt.
No, exactly. And this the Maw Demon is based on the Abyssal Maw, which is a monster from third edition that I actually like. So it's like, well, I'll draft this monster for the book because it's a low level demon. It's only level 2. But yeah, when I went to write that intro paragraph, I thought, yeah, I'm going to write about my dog.
So if I were to encounter one of these in a game, would it behoove Tabitha to maybe throw her trail rations at it and run?
That might. You know, it's really just a big walking thing of hunger. And actually, under the lore here, if you make your Arcana check, DC 19, you'll learn that it's said that a piece of meat might distract a Maw Demon long enough for opponents to retreat.
Ah, oh, very interesting.
And I know my dog will definitely go to food before anything else.
All right, so this is a good note for players out there. You need to do some research about R&D's pets.
Yes.
Because this could potentially help you in your next game. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about the whole process. Like, who is actually designing these?
So what happens with one of these books when it starts out, we will look at obviously the length of the book, how many monsters can we fit in, and we'll try to get a good sense of what percentage of creatures do we want in each tier. So generally, monster books tend toward heroic tier because that's where most people play.
Mm-hmm.
But in this book, we wanted to bring in a few more epic creatures, especially humanoid, kind of like orc-like threats in the epic tier. And then once we kind of have those sort of page count that we want to set aside for each of those categories set down, then we just go through and start drafting. And usually, like when I started with this book, I just wrote down a list of monsters that weren't in 4th edition yet that I wanted in 4th edition. So that's where the cavefisher came in. I like cavefishers. I used them back in my 2nd edition campaigns, my 1st/2nd edition campaigns. And it seems like it's a fun monster. The Maw Demon, the Abyssal Maw, I thought was just a fun, you know, it's a very low level. Again, it just hit a few right notes to me. It's a low level demon you can use for a 1st or 2nd level party. It gives them a chance to fight a demon. It's a very simple monster. It just bites things in half. It was very easy to think how to model that in 4th edition. So really, legacy is like the first thing to look at. You know, what's interesting about a creature and that hasn't been updated to 4th yet. So the Measles, another creature. It's from Fiend Folio. I like Fiend Folio. I have a soft spot for it.
I've just found a copy of that. That's a fun book.
That's a fun book.
And there are quite a few Fiend Folio monsters in Monster Manual
3. Exactly. And so the Measle I picked up because I liked the sort of flavor from the Fiend Folio. What I usually do if I pick up a monster like the Measle, and this is a monster that I designed, I will ignore everything that came after the primary source. I'm almost like a researcher. Like, I want my primary source. I go to where did it first appear and what was its undiluted form. And then with the Measle, what I'll do is, in the description of the Fiend Folio, it talks about how other monsters hate measles. They're sort of these outcasts. They're these murderer kind of guys. And I use that to inform the story I made. And I imagine, let's say in 30 years from now, I would kind of want them to do that, to do the same thing. Because while I really like what I wrote, I mean, obviously I wrote it. I would hope I like what I write. I think part of the fun of D&D, especially when you see an old monster recast, is going back to the original source and then saying what made it interesting in the first place.
Right.
And then put your own spin on it. I mean, if someone read this in 20 years and said, oh, I really like this, let's adopt this, that's fine. I guess I'd be happy. But I'd want them to first look at the original and say, well, we like this because it captures the spirit of the original. You know, I think, especially in monsters, it's easy to get this kind of copy of a copy of a copy approach. I don't really like that. I think you have to go back. You have to kind of say in 2nd or 3rd or whatever edition of D&D, that's what they did, but let's go back to the beginning and capture the essence of why this monster, people, you know, have it in mind. So the Measles, a Fiend Folio creature I liked. Other monsters that came in, the Nera, the Mirror People, those kind of made the cut for two reasons. First, we wanted like some high paragon, low epic, like what we call a tribe, like orc or goblin. Mm-hmm. And these guys fit that category pretty well because they had a pretty good story. I think they first showed up in Monster Manual 2 or may have been Fiend Folio for 3rd edition. So again, kind of going back to the original and seeing what's interesting. But this is also, if you played the Eberron RPG campaign, Mark of Heroes, back in, I think, 2004, 2005, these guys, the Nera, make an appearance in one of the adventures that kicked off that campaign. And I always liked how they were depicted there. So I kind of took the original story, added some elements for that story, that adventure, and slotted these guys into the book as like a level 18 to 22, you know, humanoid monsters you can fight.
Now, Mike, in the American Idol audition for this book, can you explain to us how the Cataleptus made it through the audition process?
So this is what happens with the Cataleptus. This guy is a monster that in 1st edition was absolutely terrifying because if it got off its gaze attack, it killed you.
Basically the death cow.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it looks a little silly, but this is the way I see it. This is the way I see all these creatures. That, you know, kind of what I mentioned before about any judging process that's a little corrupt. The Cataleptus is a classic 1st edition monster. People know about it. It's got an illustration in the 1st edition player's handbook. So I'm willing to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. He might not look all that great. He might be a little strange. He only has the one trick pony attack, which the instant death thing we're moving away from in 4th edition. But I'm like, you know what, guy? You've done yeoman's work for so long. You deserve another shot. And this is a case where I think it's easy. Some designers will look at a monster and go, this monster's lame. I'm just going to leave it there. Or it's outdated. I don't buy into that. I think when you take a monster that people know about, it has cash with the audience. People know about it. If you're a gamer, you say Cataleptus, you think it's the stupidest monster. You think, well, it killed my party back in the day. So that's kind of it's a scary monster. And to me, the challenge for a designer working on any edition of D&D, but especially now that we have all this history, is to take that original idea, what was interesting about this creature, why did Gary put it in the Monster Manual in the first place, and build on that. And I think this is a great case of I think a lot of people who don't necessarily have great creative skill would look at this and go, it's just dumb, throw it away. And not say I have the great skill, because I didn't write this monster. Steve Townsend, one of my freelancers, wrote it. I think he did a fantastic job. I think he took this monster from something that was sort of like, and or just, you know, one-dimensional that people maybe didn't like and made it something really compelling and interesting while building on its original heritage. And I think he did a great job. And I think that's the challenge whenever you have any long-term intellectual property to kind of like use like business lingo, I guess. That's the challenge. You know, it's very easy to look back and go, oh, that's it was terrible, so let's just get rid of it. But I think you're doing a disservice because people liked it at some point. And maybe it doesn't quite mesh with what is, you know, interesting now or compelling about fantasy. But that's a challenge. As a designer, take this or make it interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone can just sit down and write a new monster of whatever quality. But I think it's a bigger challenge to take something that presents some challenges and work around that. And I said, I think that monster is a great example of a designer, in this case, a freelancer, Steve Townsend, taking that challenge and really running with it. And I've seen some positive comments about it, you know. So I think that's part of it is, you know, again, it gets back to that process of, well, this creature is popular. If we drop in the name and people will recognize it. So right. let's use it. Let's not work against it. You know, let's not pick up an old name and then make it a completely new monster just for the sake of using the name. Then what's the point of using the name?
Right.
It just confuses people.
So do you solicit monsters from other people? How does this work?
So what I did with this book was we, ages ago, in a monster manual, we would have just said, hey, freelancers, come up with your own ideas. And you have two problems that come out of that. First, people tend to have similar ideas, especially when it comes to updating old monsters. Maybe everyone wants to you know, update the troll or whatever, you know. So you have that issue. But on the other hand, too, is I think it causes some chaos in the sense of you have five different people all taking their own different viewpoint and trying to make a monster manual about it. So I took kind of a heavy hand in saying, no, these are the monsters I want to see very specifically. There was a, you know, I kind of saw it as like building the big picture of this monster, the story of this book, what's going to be interesting about it. But I did give the designers some free hand at the end to say, okay, especially with some of our freelancers who hadn't done much work or any work on this before, it's kind of like, okay, prove to me that you know what you're doing, and then I'll let you make up anything you want. And that is where the Banderhob came from. That's one example of a monster. This is the guy, kind of the creature under the bed. That's another one from Steve, which I think came out very well. That was, you know, again, just make up whatever you want. And another one was the Crowd, which was another creature that I think was just created by a freelancer, Whole Cloth, which are giant, like, lobster monsters.
Lobster monsters.
And this is something where it's like, you know, some people in R&D looked and said, well, I don't know, do we want a giant lobster monster? And it's like, why not, right? And I've seen people online say, oh, that's cool, I've already used them. You know, it's a giant lobster monster at low level. It's got some fun mechanics, you know, and it's sort of getting out of that mindset of like having, you know, you want a monster book to have a range of options. You don't want it to all just be the same thing.
Right.
You know, it's easy. You know, it's funny because I if you look at, I'm going to draw in, like, I use a sports analogy because that's what I like to think. You think of soccer, and people say soccer. People in the States don't like soccer.
Nobody thinks of soccer.
Yeah.
What is soccer?
I think of soccer because the World Cup's going on right now. And I just saw the U.S., thank God, we tied Slovenia and got robbed of that third goal.
Yes.
But I'll take it anyways because all I have to do is beat Algeria next Wednesday. And I'll be watching. I'll probably take the morning off from work to watch it. I love the World Cup. I love soccer. But it'd be easy for someone to say, well, soccer, it's popular all over the world. It's not popular in the U.S. Let's change the game to make it appeal to a U.S. audience. But I think that kind of misses the point of it, right? Like, right. There's plenty of other sports. There's football, there's baseball, whatever. I think the goal of a designer is to let something be what it should be. And I think that when you look at a monster manual, it's easy to say, all these monsters should just, here's my definition of cool or interesting, and all these monsters should meet it. But I think that misses the point of a book with like a, you know, 50, 60, 70 monster entries. There's different ways people approach the game. And you shouldn't just say, here, I'm going to define X as good, and here's my rigid definition of X. I think good to me is just someone out there likes it. Now, you want everyone, and you can't make everyone like it,
right.
But you can hit different subsets of people with different approaches to monsters. So some people look at the crowd and go, it's just a giant crab. I don't see why I'd use it. But a lot of people will look at it and go, well, it's a non-humanoid monster at low levels. I can definitely use that. I'm running an ocean-based game. I can definitely use this.
Sure.
They think of the Village of Hamlet way back in the day with the giant crayfish. And, oh, this is a monster I can use in its place. You know, it's just, it appeals to a different sensibility. So it's kind of like if you took soccer and tried to make it more like American football, you're missing the point, right? I mean, you don't just make every sport look like football to make them compelling. You know, you want a palette, you want a range of options.
So why didn't you ask me to submit any monsters?
Well, because you're player in chief.
Right.
And so it wouldn't be fair because, I mean, and I think as a player in chief, it's a
conflict of interest.
Exactly.
You think?
Yes.
I think I could represent players by creating monsters.
I think you'd make easy monsters, which is fine. That's what I expect you to do as player in chief. I think, see, this is the thing. It puts you in a bad position. You either make a monster that kills someone's character, and then someone's like, you're the player in chief and you killed my character, you'd feel terrible.
Yeah, I would.
But then if you make an easy monster, the players might think they're happy. We're not being challenged. This is great. But deep down inside, they know it's fake.
Okay. Well, I guess that's a good point.
We saved you from yourself.
But so I'm certainly people in the building did contribute to this book.
So
what if you didn't like a monster? Like, what if Jeremy was really excited about this monster and he submitted it and you had to reject it?
So this is, well, part of that was the approach when I made up the list myself at the beginning. What it does is, and this is a subtle thing, I don't think I ever came untold someone this, but it lets me know as the designer.
Sound like Oprah. I get people admit things.
So, like, if you look at the Dread Warrior.
Mike will soon reveal all of his secrets.
Yeah.
Take note, everyone.
Here's a good example. Like, if you look at the Minotaur entry, right, that's on the list. So the freelancer knows, well, I've been asked to make Minotaurs. If I make Minotaurs, I'm not going to get in trouble. That's what they want.
Minotaurs. Really? Are any of them named Kevin?
Of course not. It's a terrible name for a Minotaur. But what it does, though, I think what it as a manager, whatever that means for creative people, like, you know, when you're writing a book like this, you have these people working for you. You're not there to tell them what to do. You're there to make them be as creative as they possibly can be. I think creativity really works very well if you give people some interesting boundaries. So it's like, okay, do Minotaurs instead of just do whatever you want, because then I think it almost paralyzes people. But if you say, okay, I want you to design some new variants on this existing creature, it kind of gives them the place to start with. They kind of maybe have a better foundation under their feet creatively where they want to go next. And then it also means it's easier for me because I can say, look, like, I don't remember if this particular monster with the Minotaurs what happened, but it may come back and I'd say, they're not savage enough. I want them to be a little more brutal. In this case, I think we got some great design, but this is where it come back. The freelancer could have just written, well, here's a new Minotaur soldier, here's a new Minotaur with an axe, here's a Minotaur with plate mail. He came back with this great story of a Minotaur cult that builds mazes, they lure creatures into it. When the creatures are lost, they kill them and eat their hearts and gain their powers.
Ugh.
It's basically a cult of Baphomet.
I gotta wonder about
Minotaurs.
Where is this inspiration coming from?
But it's great. So we have Minotaurs with like abilities taken from Gorgons, from unicorns, from vampires. It's great, and it gives them a nice flavor. A nice story that I think makes this could have just been a Minotaur with an axe, but no, it's a Minotaur who's a member of this weird cult who's gaining these powers. And I love that stuff. And I think that's kind of what you want to put people in a position, creative people in a position to be creative. You don't want to just dictate them. This isn't the army. I'm not just telling them march like this and do exactly this A, B, C, D checklist kind of approach to creativity. It doesn't work. You've got to, it's like soccer. You need to give people some space to, you know, to play.
Wow, you really have World Cup on the brain.
I love the World Cup.
It's so brilliant. I love the World Cup. I think it's the best sporting event.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I know you guys are very busy. This is Shelley Mazenoble, player in chief. Until next time.
So Monster Manual 3, following in our 4th edition tradition of having a big classic D&D bad guy on the cover, has Lolf. In Monster Manual 1, we had Orcus. The Orcus mini is standing right in front of us, in fact.
It's a little mascot today.
Yes. Looking like he's about to smash into our table when we have our microphone.
Take out the mic.
But also in Monster Manual 3, we have some other classic D&D bad guys making a return. Two of the elemental princes of evil.
Yes! We have Ogremok and we have Imix. So obviously they're from the first edition Monster Manual, so I like them because that's my favorite D&D book of all time.
clearly, since this book is jam-packed with monsters from that book.
That book has low lows but high highs.
Yeah.
And I thought they fit in pretty well with the cosmology we built for 4th edition. And it kind of fits also in the idea of having some more epic tier threats, a little more epic in this book. And I just like the story behind them. So they were pretty obvious to include.
So fans of the original Fiendfolio are going to be wondering, when are we going to see the return of the other elemental princes? Princes like Cryonax or Yancy Bin.
Yeah. No, so Cryonax and Olhydra, I would not be surprised if we end up covering those guys at some point. And who's to say that those five are the only five? I mean, I think we could easily do more new ones. And that's why I like doing new stuff in the context of like, oh, this is the old thing and here's the new part of it. I think that's always kind of I think that's interesting to D&D players. Yancy Bin, though, is sort of interesting because the name, I don't know, Is it a name from folklore or something? Is there some mythological thing there? I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was from Asian folklore.
So that's something we'd probably look at to see, well, is there a real world background here?
Right.
I'm also biased because I think I prefer Pazuzu, the demon lord of the air, of aerial things, as being more of this evil aerial mastermind kind of guy. I think he's just more interesting. So I don't know exactly what do we do with Yancy Bin. I think I'd almost be tempted to do new guys first before trying to cover him. The name is just, it doesn't do much for me. But,
you know, Yancy Bin could be in a similar category to the Catablepus, where...
That's true.
It's not your thing, but I'm sure there are some fans who would be delighted to see the return of good old Yancy Bin.
And that's true. That's really just a matter of, like, finding... And I think what I'd rather do is come up with a great story and bring him forward, or just maybe kind of not talk about him until we have something cool to go with.
Yeah.
I don't want to just bring something forward, essentially just bring it forward as is for no reason other than nostalgia. I think that's selling the audience short.
Right.
You know,
right.
You could completely preserve it, but I think you'd want to say, because, oh, this is great, people like it. I don't know how many Yancy Bin fans there are out there.
Yeah. Well, and the key is, anytime we're bringing something forward, is we want to preserve what people loved about
it,
but also introduce something new about that element, or polish something old, and so people see it in a new way.
Exactly. I mean, it kind of gets back to what I was talking about before, you know, going back to the original source and emphasizing what was interesting about it when it first appeared.
Yeah.
So.
I'm very excited to be here today with Rob Schwalm. A name that is probably very familiar to a lot of you because it appears on a lot of your D&D product. Aww.
Oh, I'm going to cry.
Welcome to Seattle.
Oh, well, thank you.
Or Renton, I guess, officially.
You can see Seattle, kind of.
Yeah, you can kind of see it in the distance.
Yeah.
It's nice to meet you in person, as we were just talking about. We are Facebook acquaintances.
We are, the best way.
Which is like the real thing.
It is. I mean, it's just like we're in the same room all the time.
Kind of.
It's like I'm staring at you while you sleep.
I always know what you're doing.
Right.
And you always know what things my cat
is doing.
Has done to me. So, good to have you here.
Yes, it's good to be here.
And I guess probably the purpose of your trip is somewhat interesting. I'm sure you're here just not coincidentally. This is probably a business-related
trip. Well, actually, the story is that I was stalking Tina Yothers, and I'm kind of hiding out for a couple days.
Is she here in Seattle?
No, because it's really embarrassing. That probably wouldn't interest fans. But
Are you kidding? Well, you can tell me after.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Definitely intrigued.
Yeah. No, and in addition, I felt there was a good place to hide out while I was trying to escape the cops. And there's some business stuff, you know, and I also need to hold James's hand for a bit.
Oh.
Yeah. If I go more than 6 months without James White contact, I break out into hives.
I'm telling you, a lot of people feel that way. Yeah.
It's a soothing presence.
He's very soothing. Very nice to see James Wyatt once in a while. But you freelance, and you do a lot of work for Wizards, which we're very fortunate to
have you. Well,
that's
very sweet to say.
But what is your background with D&D, I guess, in particular?
So I broke into the business, right after college, after I went back to college. It would have been 2001. There was an open call for a D20 company, and I started there. Then I served, I was hired by Green Ronin Publishing, and was line developer for D20, for the D20 system, and line developer for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and Song of Ice and Fire, and a variety of other projects. And then Wizards made an offer that I couldn't refuse, and so I left that job, and now I'm working full-time as a contractor for Wizards.
So when did you first start playing D&D?
I was in sixth grade. My neighbor, Kyle Crow, who's out there somewhere.
Hi, Kyle.
He sold me Rahazia for 25 cents, and I didn't have the game or anything like that, so I decided I was going to make my own role-playing game based on Rahazia.
Oh, see, it started even back then.
I was a game designer in sixth grade. I had 12 to 14 fellow classmates in the playground, and we played Passages. I realized my first game design error when you crossed from one side of the map to the other, and the players grew wise to this, so they would go back and forth on the side of the map when they gained levels. So, yeah, I figured I tried that again, but it just keeps getting shot down. So we're now done with that. But I started with a red box shortly after that, and I graduated to Advanced D&D and have played ever since.
You've played ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of people that probably envy what you do, and what sort of advice would you have for future game designers?
You can expect to make hundreds and hundreds of dollars a year.
What? I'm totally in the wrong line of work here.
No, it's game design is all about persistence and trying to get your foot in the door and get people to notice you and making sure that you turn over your stuff on time and as clean as possible and to be very professional with who you deal with. No whining, no complaining.
At least not to their face.
Right.
When you hang up the phone or...
You can cry to yourself and rail at the gods and stuff like that.
But yeah. Channel that into your work.
Totally. That's how I do it.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And the other thing is that you always have to keep writing every day. You've got to keep designing new stuff all the time. And even if... And that way you can pull back from it later on. So if you have... I've got a file of 500 feet. You know, that's something that you can pull from when you get your first assignment, and it'll save you a lot of headaches down the road. Even if it's not all useful then, it may be down the road.
Yeah. So it just never stops. I mean, you're always working.
Right.
You're always thinking about.
Yeah. I put out about between 6 and last month, 14,000 words a day.
What?
Yeah. Well,
14,000 words a day?
For 19 days, I averaged 12,000 words a day, and I range from 8,000 to about 16,000 every day.
So where does your inspiration come from? Because, I mean, if you're cranking out 14,000 words a day and you're constantly working and you're doing this full time.
Fear.
Okay.
Yeah, fear of failure.
Fear is a good motivator.
Yeah. Fear of failure and disappointment.
Fear of failure and disappointment can also make people shut down and not do anything, though. For you, it seems to have the opposite.
I also drink a lot.
Oh.
So that takes care of it all.
For all you kids out there.
Yeah, for the young ones. Yeah, you got to start drinking now.
Uh-oh. Okay.
I'm kidding. Don't do drugs.
No, absolutely not. I mean, this is totally off the topic, but in the land of microbrews, you are taking advantage of
our offerings. I had Bud Light last night.
Oh, nice.
And I have not found Coors. But no, I did see Coors last night, too. So, yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Coors.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, projects that you're working on now? Anything you can tell us about?
No.
Okay. But I do know... Something you are working on, which is very exciting to me. I'm a big fan of Gamma World.
Yes, I can tell you about that.
Tell us a little bit about Gamma World.
So I was recruited to design the first expansion box, Famine and Fargo. And it is a wacky, wacky world of mutants, guns, and more mutants and more guns.
Hence the reason I'm very excited about it.
It has mutant one-eyed chickens. The adventure, the box set was inspired by the original 32-page adventure from way back when. And so I try to be as true to the spirit of that adventure. And so I brought a lot of stuff in. The Gallus 516. They're the one-eyed mutant chicken guys. And
I love this game.
And then I also was able to sneak in a few old D&D monsters that haven't appeared yet, like the Frogamoth and the Garbug, that's the flying lobster. One of my favorite monsters ever.
Nice.
Yeah. Carbuncle was already done, so I couldn't do that one. But I wanted to bring that guy in. So maybe in the future.
Yes. Keep him in your back pocket.
Right.
So to speak.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Probably not. But,
we could get uncomfortable.
It could be ugly. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Were you excited to work on that?
I was. I came up in November to do to kind of get a look at the rules and to play test. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with the game because I can play a tracked plastic man. And now with the Famine of Fargo, you can play a gelatinous yeti.
Are you serious?
Yeah. You could probably play a tracked gelatinous cube if you wanted to.
I might. So Gamma World, obviously exciting, but what other projects have you worked on in the past that you really got into?
Dark Sun was just hot. It was, pun intended.
Oh, look at that.
All night long was I waiting to use that one. I sat up and rocked back and forth. Anyway, no. Dark Sun was great. I had a good time with that. I was a huge fan. I got to mess around with killing things again, which is my favorite thing to do in D&D.
Good that you specify in D&D.
Oh, yeah. Right, Tina Yethers? Don't worry.
Oh, Tina.
God. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, so Dark Sun was great. Dark Sun, we got a chance to go back to the original box set and kind of relaunch from there. All the stuff that happened afterwards can all still happen in your Dark Sun game, so if you've been playing Dark Sun since the 90s, we haven't invalidated anything. It's just we brought up the rules so that you can play it in 4th edition. It is... awesome, cool. It's the most fun I've had in a campaign, on a project in a long time.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
So I know you're busy. I know that you are not just here to talk about vegetarian food and light beer.
Yeah.
Although We should do that.
Yeah.
So I'll let you get back to it, but I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
And it really was very, very nice to meet you.
Yes, definitely.
All right. So this is Shelley Mazanoble signing off.
Thanks a lot for tuning in. On behalf of Jeremy, I want to thank Shelley for coming by and asking some interesting questions of us. And as usual, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, drop us an email to dndinsider@wizards.com. And until next episode, keep playing D&D.